From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest, Lee Billings, is a senior editor for space and physics at Scientific American. Now, there's no one, we're certain, who loves his job more than Lee. We know this because we've spoken to him several times on Cool Science Radio. We spoke to him back in February about Alpha Centauri. We've invited him back today to talk about maybe a possible conflict in space between technology and astronomy. That is, if anyone viewed the SpaceX satellites that were very visible to the naked eye several weeks ago, well, they may have thoughts that it was a certain line of UFOs. It was actually the latest development in technology. Lee joins us to talk about that and other stories from space. Lee Billings, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Ben, John, great to be here. And I do love my job. Let's get into it.
Okay. So I was camping a couple weeks ago, and I had heard or, you know, seen headlights here and there about SpaceX satellites and how you could see them. And we were around the campfire talking, and suddenly there they were, this line of satellites, very bright, very visible to the naked eye in the northwest sky. And I thought, wow, no wonder people thought those were UFOs. So why so visible is my first question.
Yeah, sure. So they're visible because they're freshly launched, essentially. They get less visible as they go higher into their working orbits, as I understand it. Essentially, though, what Starlink is it's a shell of satellites that's under construction that's going to be passing over kind of the entire Earth. And they're a little lower in orbit, a little lower in altitude than traditional satellites that provide internet, because that's what these things do. They provide internet to places all around the world, high-speed internet, that otherwise can't get it. Most satellites that do that are in what's called geostationary orbit, which is in the vicinity of, I think, 220,000 kilometers above the planet, quite high up, right? And so they're very hard to see, but that also means they have a very long latency time. So, you know, if you're trying to play a video game or do a Zoom conference, that doesn't necessarily work very well because you have a long lag time between when you say something and other people hear it. So the whole point of Starlink is to just have a lower latency for this internet from space, and that means they're lower in the sky and they're brighter. But they do get a little dimmer as they reach their operational orbits, and SpaceX is testing out, with cooperation from astronomers, various ways to dim the satellites to make them less obtrusive, because the problem is not only can they pass over a campsite where you can see them and marvel at them or say, shake your fist and, I wanted to see the Milky Way, but I'm seeing these satellites instead. They can also pass over world-leading observatories that may be trying to study things like the expansion of the universe or distant supernovas or look for life on other planets, whatever have you. And they can get in the way of some of those observations. So that's kind of where the conflict comes in.
Right. So I understand the conflict, and yet I will say that people, when their eyes are drawn to space in the evening, in the night sky, there may be this added fascination with what's going on out there. I know it had that effect on me. And while I love to look at constellations, I was quite fascinated with this line of satellites. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers. So say 10 years ago, somewhere around 200 satellites were in the sky, and it seems as though we're heading for 30,000 or so. So can you talk to us about those numbers?
Yeah, of course. So actually, I think, was it just yesterday? It might have been just yesterday, or if not yesterday, then the day before, SpaceX did its latest Starlink launch, where they added 52 satellites in one launch with one of their mostly reusable Falcon 9 rocket launches. And you can see just from that one launch, distributing 52 of these, when you're doing a lot of these each year, the numbers add up very quickly. So to date, right now, SpaceX has a little more than 1,500 Starlink satellites are there. They have plans to go up as high as 42,000 satellites up there for Starlink. And we have to keep in mind, SpaceX is not the only player in this game. There is also something called Project Kuiper from Amazon that wants to do the same thing. They want to have several thousand satellites up there. There's another company called OneWeb that just emerged from bankruptcy recently that also already has some satellites there and has plans of its own for thousands more. Additionally, there are somewhat nascent plans for these so-called mega constellations from Russia and from China. You can easily imagine a scenario where we suddenly have, if not tens, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit, which is kind of scary, because when you have that much stuff up there, space is really big. There's lots of room for everybody in space. But when you have that much stuff up there, it does increase the risks of collisions and those sorts of events. That's a problem, because when things collide in space, they're moving very fast. And they create a lot of debris. And each one of those pieces of debris can be as small as, you know, a staple, or as big as a radiator or you know, an AC unit from a window. Those things are also moving very fast. They can crash into things and create more debris. So you can get in a kind of a really nasty cascading scenario of debris being generated that makes the entire orbital environment much more risky and dangerous for assets up there. So it's kind of a tragedy of the commons situation that might be unfolding in the near future if we do get these tens or even hundreds of thousands of satellites operational.
Well, recently in the last Dragon capsule launch, they had to change their position because of space debris that travels very, I guess the space debris can travel about 12,500 miles an hour, and that could destroy a capsule. So we're starting to see problems with it now. And, you know,
indeed.
Yeah. So I was curious, let's just talk about the business of Starlink. I understand that there are people in remote locations that do not have high speed internet, and I'm all for them having it because it'll help their kids get through school and get their homework done and help them communicate and all those sorts of things. And there are second and third world countries that have large swaths of territory that are not supported by internet. But the question that I have is it commercially viable for the rest of us? I mean, right now, it's $500 for the mountable satellite dish. It's $99 a month for the service. The latency delay can be 40, 50, 60 milliseconds. They're getting 150 megabits per second on the download, but we seem to get more of that with a good fiber connection.
Indeed, indeed, yeah. I think for most folks who are relatively near population centers, urban centers, you know, suburban areas even, I think that ground-based fiber optic is probably going to be the way to go with, you know, some wireless interchanges here and there. But as you said, the real value here is for places that lack a lot of that sort of infrastructure right now. So whether that's on the peak, on a rocky peak somewhere, you know, maybe right there in Utah, or whether that's instead in sub-Saharan Africa, right? There is an immense demand, I think, for this service. And you know, we probably will be seeing higher data rates and more reliability, and I would guess dropping costs as these networks of mega constellations roll out. So I think that, you know, it is a very privileged kind of a you know, first world problem, you could say, to be an astronomer and say, oh, you know, these strings of pearl-like strings of satellites passing overhead are really ruining my observations of some distant supernova. You know, we really can't have that. When meanwhile, you know, maybe that's what's going to allow some future Einstein or some future Marie Curie from sub-Saharan Africa to, you know, to properly develop and get educated and hooked into the global economy and the global ecosystem of ideas. So I think we have to be careful in our criticisms here, and it's a balance. We need to find a middle way to allow the entire planet to be properly wired up and interlinked, while also preserving some sense of sanctity for the night sky, so that we can all share that common human heritage of looking up into the heavens and being astounded, not just by passing strings of satellites, but by the stars and the Milky Way.
And Lee, I'm curious about something. We have space weather that we monitor every day. It's really important. There's solar flares. There's all sorts of different things. Our atmosphere protects us from a lot. Back in 2012, there were two colossal mass ejections. The acronym is CME, I guess, of plasma that just missed the Earth's orbit by a couple of weeks. It would have been lights out. It would have been a situation where be sort of Mad Max in the Thunderdome for several years because some of these electrical devices on Earth take 2 years to build. So if they got fried, but now we have early warning and those sorts of things. My question is,
sure,
the new satellites that we're putting up, forget Elon Musk for a moment, the ones that NASA puts up are ruggedized. They're when space weather comes through and there's a CME heading our way, they can face it in another direction. They can turn it off temporarily so it doesn't get fried. With 30,000 of these small, really cost-effective, economical satellites, is Musk or SpaceX able to reposition them or be able to turn them in a certain way so they don't get fried by a colossal mass ejection of plasma?
So indeed, yes, there is. I think the technical term here is active station keeping, maybe, or where you essentially can, there's little thrusters on these things, and they can gently tweak their orbits because it does take a little nudge. And because you're moving so fast, all of a sudden you can be in a pretty substantially different orbit change the timing of things so it reduces the risk of collisions and things. And they do those sorts of maneuvers already to minimize risks for things like the International Space Station. These things could be turned off and they can be slightly reoriented to deal with problems with space weather. The bigger problem, as I understand it, with some sorts of space weather for satellites is not only that their electronics should be fried, for instance, and then they need to be turned off temporarily to avoid that, right? It's also that the waves of plasma from something like a coronal mass ejection, a CME, can actually cause the upper atmosphere to kind of puff up, get a little puffier. And when that happens, that can increase drag on the satellite. So even though they're technically in space, they're still actually in the very outskirts of the Earth's atmosphere. And when the Earth's atmosphere puffs up like that and the drag increases, that means there's more friction. They're gonna fall faster. They're going to lose momentum faster. And so they're going to come to Earth faster. Now, Starlink and similar mega constellations, it's kind of a, you could say it's a feature, not a bug, that they drag on the atmosphere because that's one natural way they're able to be disposed of, that they're able to, when it comes to the end of their life or when they aren't operational, they can just kind of drift into the atmosphere and burn up on reentry. But if the atmosphere is puffed up, that will change the equation, so to speak. That will mean some of them will reenter maybe faster than they would otherwise, or they'll have to use more fuel to keep from reentering. So it's a kind of a delicate balance, but it is, these are problems that are solvable and that are already pretty much solved, I think, in terms of technology. It's just a matter of implementation.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Lee Billings. He is a senior editor for space and physics at Scientific American. Lee, give our listeners an idea. So say these over 1,500 satellites that have been launched recently just by SpaceX, about how big are they?
Gosh, they're bigger than you think. I don't have the dimensions offhand on me, but I'm actually sitting in my young son's nursery, and I'm looking at one of his play tables, which I guess is about a meter. Let's just say a meter each side. I think they're on the order of that. I think they're the size of kind of like a decent mid-sized coffee table. They're kind of big.
Okay.
When they actually extend their antennae and so on and so forth, they're even a little bigger than that. So they're really, really tiny. When space is so big and there's so much room up there, they do kind of fade to little tiny points, it seems like.
Right. Back to debris in space. I was also, the same evening that I saw the line of the UFOs, i.e. SpaceX satellites, and I shouldn't even say that, it's propagating misinformation, but there was also something that we saw in the sky, which we decided had to be that Chinese rocket that we heard was going to crash, come into orbit, and mostly kind of deconstruct, but land somewhere. And we saw what I think it was, and Ina, that was my question for you, was I just seeing a particularly colorful shooting star like I've never seen before, or was it the rocket coming into orbit?
Well, it's hard for me to say because I don't quite know the exact timing or location, but there's certainly a chance that that's what you saw, The risk of space debris, there's kind of two different categories, right? There's the stuff that whirls around over our head that can pepper satellites kind of like very, very high speed buckshot and rip them to shreds, making more debris. That's one problem. And then another problem is, hey, is something going to fall on my head from out there? Right. And, a lot of the Chinese government, China has gotten a lot of flack over this, and quite understandably, no one wants to have a big rocket stage fall on their head. Of course, they dump rocket stages all the time on villagers in remote parts of China, downrange from where they launch rockets. But it's an uncomfortable thing to think that this could happen to you anywhere on the planet, essentially, from an errant rocket launch. However, China's not the only one that has done this. Actually, before this rocket fell, the last heaviest thing that fell to Earth from space, I believe, was from the U.S., and that was Skylab, which was a big space station that was launched in part of one of the old kind of refurbished or repurposed moon rockets that took the Apollo astronauts to the moon. So Skylab had also experienced an uncontrolled reentry. And parts that I think fell on the remote, I believe, Australian outback. No one was hurt, though. And similarly, in this case, the rocket did end up coming down to Earth, it looks like, and splashing down parts of it in the Indian Ocean, kind of off the coast of the Maldives? I don't even know how to say it.
Maldives, yeah.
Yeah, and so thankfully, most of the planet, we call it Earth. It's probably better called ocean because more than 70% of its surface is water. So chances are that when something does happen like this, it will splash down. And unless you're a particularly unlucky fisherman or a swimmer or something like that, you're probably pretty safe. But it is a growing problem. As more and more stuff is launched up there, we will have to deal more and more with these sorts of problems back on Earth.
Lee, starting in the 1950s, people started observing what they thought were UFOs. Popular culture certainly supported it with their B and C class movies of aliens coming and getting us. And Project Blue Book was assembled. And, they talked about weather satellites. Well, no, it was a reflection from a cloud. No, the guy was hallucinating. And many of the films that were provided of these unidentified flying objects were really cheesy, and you could tell that they were made at home and stuff. Now recently the Pentagon has admitted that they believe that there's something going on. They don't know what it is, but it's a technology that we, the Chinese, the Indians, the Iranians, don't possess, and that this technology appears to be between 100 and 1,000 years ahead of us. For an example, being able to drop 80,000 feet in less than a second and then be able to disappear. And they have sophisticated tracking devices on these fighter jets. And so they're really starting to take a peek. What do you think?
Well, it's tough. I don't want to cavalierly and ignorantly discount the data that's gathered by a whole host of sensors, of which we don't even necessarily have a lot of exposure to or awareness of in military hardware. I also don't want to discount the first-person observations of experienced eyewitnesses, airmen and such like that. Fundamentally, it is pretty tough to know exactly what you're seeing out there in a lot of the situations. I'm not saying that there's nothing to be seen. I'm not saying that there isn't something curious and interesting going on in Earth's skies and has been going on for decades now. Is it little green men? Is it extraterrestrial interlopers who are monitoring us somehow? I feel like it's a little premature to say that with any kind of certainty. I think it's important to keep your mind open, but just not so open that your brain falls out, right? And I think that applies in both directions. So, to people who are saying, okay, it's definitely the Argonians from Zeta Reticuli, the lizard people, or, I'd be like, I don't know about that. But the people who say, it's just a reflection of light off of some pocket of swamp gas, or you've been drinking too much, pal, or something like that, give me a break. I think the Pentagon obviously has a vested interest in studying these things, because if it is an Earth-based technology, then that means that a potential adversary or full-on adversary maybe has the one up on us in all kinds of interesting ways. So it's a legit area of study. Occam's razor is applicable here. What's more likely? that it's some sort of alien surveillance from beyond the solar system. Interstellar travel is really, really hard, or that it's something that someone cooked up here in a lab on Earth and some sort of a black program in aerospace. So I don't know, but I do think it's interesting. I'm looking forward to the report that's going to be released apparently next month from the U.S. government that will summarize some of what the Pentagon knows. I don't anticipate there will be any huge revelations there, but I would love to be proved wrong.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's going to be in late June. I'm not sure how much data is going to be in it. I'm not buying into little green men, but I am very curious and very interested. And of course, when people say to you, hey, listen, if there is some sort of surveillance, why aren't they talking to us? Well, when you walk through the woods and you see a squirrel, you don't sit down and try to talk to the squirrel. because honestly, we are a pretty boring, aggressive group of race of people, and we've only been around for 300,000 years, and the universe has been around for, they believe, about 13.7 billion years. So if there is life out there, then, and if there is intelligent life, it's a good chance it could be a lot more sophisticated than ours, and they could just be indifferent to us.
Could be. I mean, I'll say to add is that, there's a it's really hard to travel between stars, even to get to, let's say something like a tenth the speed of light. If you have something, let's say, the size of a 737 aircraft, and even if it's the smallest you could get that sort of mission for us into, accelerating that thing to a tenth the speed of light to get to something like Alpha Centauri in more than 40 years, that would take about as much power as we generate in the entire United States, about 150 years of it. So it's an immense amount of energy to cross the stars, even nearby stars. But if someone could do that, I think the interesting question is, if something could do that sort of thing, maybe they'd be able to hide themselves from us quite effectively, right? So one other thing to note really quickly is that, we're all walking around now with rather sophisticated recording devices. I'm talking to you on a smartphone. I can pull it out of my pocket. I can take pictures. I can record audio, do video, all that stuff. And these are nearly ubiquitous now across the planet. Interestingly enough, though, despite the fact that we all have these relatively sophisticated audiovisual recorders on our person at almost all times, you're not seeing a market uptick either in quantity or quality of these reports. So even though everyone's walking around with an iPhone, there isn't a huge increase in the number of sightings and videos and pictures. And that's kind of interesting. Now, I think that to me would suggest, I don't know. I don't quite know what that suggests. To me, that says there's probably more going on than just some kind of external alien influence.
Yeah, that's also interesting. Well, we will look forward to that report in June. Lee, before we let you go, and we just have a few minutes left, I wanted to ask you about, back in February, about February 18th, Mars Perseverance rover landed on Mars, and it was really exciting. We really look forward to it. We talked to people about it. I know you wrote a lot about it. And then on May 14th, with very little fanfare, at least from maybe American media, a Chinese rover, three months later, Zhurong, I think it's called, Chinese pronunciation is not good, but landed also on Mars. And I just wanted to ask you what the differences are between that rover, Zhurong, and what Perseverance is doing.
So, Zhurong is, first of all, it's amazing that China has pulled this off, because we have to keep in mind that they're still relatively new to the space game. This is their first attempt to land on Mars, and it was successful. There's only one other nation on the planet that has successfully landed and operated spacecraft on Mars, and that's the U.S. Mm-hmm. Now, our first is back in 1976 with the Viking mission, but they it is really audacious they pulled this off. So I want to say that up front. The Zhurong rover is no Perseverance. Perseverance has more capable instruments. I believe it has more power available to it. But Zhurong's still been doing a lot of really cool work where it is. It landed what's called Utopia Planitia, which is in the northern part of the planet, actually not that far from where the Viking 2 lander landed back in 1976. And there's lots of interesting features nearby that it can trundle to. One of the things that's cool about the lander is its top speed. Both of these rovers, the Zhurong rover and the Perseverance rover, can drive autonomously, which is what you need to do since you have something like a 10 or something even close to 20-minute light travel time between the planets, right? So you can't just actively control it from a control room on Earth. They have to kind of autonomously do some of their work. Well, the Zhurong rover, I believe, can drive about 200 meters per hour, which sounds kind of slow, but it's actually extremely fast since it's on another planet autonomously. And I believe Perseverance can only go about half that far. Or actually, not even half that far. Perseverance is slower. So Zhurong appears to be faster, but it's also smaller, not quite as capable. It only weighs about 240 kilograms, whereas Perseverance is about the size of like a Mini Cooper. It's a car driving around on Mars, and it's a little slower. So, you know, China is a little more nimble here, and it'll be doing things like driving the rover to perhaps investigate a nearby feature that might be a mud volcano near its landing site, which could be cool. You know, people are interested in looking for life on Mars. Maybe there's some little green bugs that are living in the base of that mud volcano. We could find out pretty soon, but we'll have to chalk up or bone up on our Chinese first, I think, to really,
exactly.
Really maybe get those discoveries.
So yeah. That's why I read a headline saying that geologists were really excited about that. That's why, that it can just go faster and maybe see more. And maybe it's this mud volcano that they're excited about. So good. All right. Well, Lee Billings, it's been a pleasure having you back on Cool Science Radio. Always happy to talk to you. And your interest and passion for space is palpable even through the phone line. So thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.